Ladies and gentlemen, when you hear the Shadow's blood-curdling laugh, you can be sure that exciting entertainment will follow.
You can't prove it. Oh, oh. You got nothing legit. Oh, oh. The glove don't fit. Oh, oh. You gotta quit. Oh, oh. I didn't smoke it. Oh, oh. That's all you're gonna get. Oh, oh. I'll never admit. Oh, oh. I never took a hit. Oh, oh. The charges won't stick. Cause Monday morning I'm a brand new man. Tuesday catch me if you can. Wednesday night.
Welcome to The Docket, episode 77. My name is Michael Spratt.
Hi, I'm Emily Tamman.
Hey, Emily Tamman, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Michael Spratt?
Great.
You had an adventurous evening tonight.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I was walking the dog around the pond in our neighborhood, sort of like 8 o'clock, so sun going down, and I turn the corner and there's like a woman in the middle of this like dirt trail crying on the ground, grabbing her ankle. Turns out she broke her ankle and was, I think, simultaneously having an addictions and mental health issue. So I hung out with her for, like half an hour. Luckily, two young lads with their fishing rods coming back from the local fishing hole, because that's the type of community we live in, were walking by. So I sent one of them out to wait for the ambulance, and the other and I waited with her and until the ambulance came.
Not what you expected when you took the dog out for a walk.
No. Oh, and in the middle of that, as I'm on the phone with 911, dealing with her mental health issue, dealing with her stomach-turning ankle injury, some dog came and attacked Dexter and pinned him down to the ground, and he was, like, yelping. And so I'm, like, on the phone, and dogs are going around, and she's this, and the pill bottle's falling out of her pockets. Like, it was bizarre, but I'm glad that we live in a community where some nice people were there to help me, and the paramedics, the Ottawa paramedics, props to them. They came super quickly and were super calm and had it all under control.
Just, wow.
Yeah, so anyway.
Yeah, so this is your evening.
Typical dog walk.
Sure. Yeah, crazy. So that was your evening. We had a really busy weekend, so that was kind of the culmination of a long and emotional weekend coming off the backs of a pretty devastating provincial election.
Oh, Doug, a new day has dawned in Ontario, and it's the Doug Ford era.
Yeah, that's going to be an adjustment for all of us.
Yeah, so I mean, I think we talked about it last time, how I met him on the street. Did we talk about that?
I don't remember. I don't
know. So when we were in Toronto, we met him on the street, and I went up to pose for a picture with him. Well, Emily, you were heckling him.
I heckled him a little bit. I mean, I was simply just advising him that we weren't going to be supporting him in the upcoming election. I don't know that it's fair to characterize that as a heckle per se. It was a statement of fact.
It's true. And then to his credit, he actually like stopped, talked to us and said, "So you're NDP supporters. I bet you don't have Andrea Horvath's cell phone number," which I think you'll probably get in touch with her if you want to. But then he gave us his cell phone number.
To which I subsequently said, "Let the trolling begin."
Well, and then a couple days later, the Ottawa Police, there's a story in the CBC about how the Ottawa Police Association were endorsing the Progressive Conservatives because the Ottawa Police don't like the new restrictions on carding and they don't like the new law about police oversight. And so they were supporting the PCs because they said that Doug Ford would, you know, roll those back and be more liberal with respect to carding and more restrictive with respect to civil rights. And so I thought, hey, I've got his cell phone number. He said text him if I ever need anything. So I texted Doug Ford Friday morning and asked him, hey, the Ottawa police say that you don't, or that you're in favor of carding and that you will bring in looser police oversight. And 2 hours later, I get a phone call from Dougie Ford.
And lo and behold, would it be fair to say that he told you what you wanted to hear?
Doug Ford does not support carding. He is against it. And he says that, these are exact words, "My friend, there's no bigger supporter of the police than me, but I know there's bad apples. So I'm going to make sure that I look at the oversight legislation line by line, because we need to be able to have oversight of the police to make sure that, you know, bad apples don't spoil the bunch."
So there was that.
And then he was elected.
Now, in terms of his commitment to ensuring that bad apples not spoil the bunch, perhaps he could have practiced what he preaches and simply withdrawn from the race.
Or, as he was talking to me for 20 minutes, and I sort of had to get him off the phone, I was thinking, dude, you're in the middle of an election campaign. This doesn't bode well for your decision making, because you could be like campaigning or maybe fully costing your promises and platform. But no, you're talking with me on the phone. I mean, good for him, I guess.
Well, that's the number one plank of his brand, is that, you know, he returns calls. So I think this was something we already knew about him, and it turns out, I guess, to be accurate. We'll see how effective he is at keeping that up as premier. But given that he was able to do it during an election campaign, we'll see. I'm just not sure how, speaking for myself, I don't know that my number one priority in a premier is that I can personally get the premier on the phone as a member of the public at any time. But that's his brand, and apparently it's a true characterization.
And I mean, the other good thing, I guess, about having his personal cell phone number, which I'm sure billions of people have at this point, I'm writing an op-ed that should be coming out on Monday, the day that we're going to release this, an open letter to Doug Ford about some things that he can do with respect to the courts and the justice system to perhaps find efficiencies and increase fairness. And so I'll make sure I text him a link to that and see if he responds to us.
Yes, to be continued.
But before we go on and talk about you know, our very interesting and good topics, we have a new sponsor. Yeah, Yimond, you're dead to us. Take a listen to this.
Ladies and gentlemen, when you hear the Shadow's blood-curdling laugh, you can be sure that exciting entertainment will follow. And here's something else that you can be sure of. When you buy Blue Coal, you're getting the finest of Pennsylvania hard coal. The harmless blue coloring that identifies Blue Coal is your guarantee of clean, even, safe, dependable heat all winter long. So don't take chances. Insist on Blue Coal. Ask for it by name. Phone your order to your nearest Blue Coal dealer tomorrow.
There you go. It's the finest andesite that you're ever going to find.
What the heck is Blue Coal?
It takes care of your heating needs.
How? Explain.
This is why I'm against shutting down Ontario's coal fire plants. Because we don't have the opportunity to have fancy sponsors like that that went out of business in like the 1930s.
Something you may not know about Mike Spratt, if it hasn't come up previously on the podcast, is that he has a love for old-timey radio shows. And one of the things he most enjoys about them is listening to the old-timey radio commercials. Emon Publishing, you are not dead to us. You are, in fact, still our sponsor. But Blue Coal is a ridiculous product that we felt the need to recognize on today's episode.
So I will say that this episode is brought to you by Emon Publishing's criminal law series, For Reals. This series offers practical and procedural guidance for both defense and Crown Counsel, anchored by the expertise of General Editors Brian H. Greenspan and Justice Vincenzo Rondinelli.
Yep.
And, you know, maybe in the next 70 years from now, someone can drag out that audio and put it on their little fun podcast or whatever they have.
And I'm sure they will.
So what are we talking about?
So we're going to talk briefly about a piece that we read in the CBC that we thought was interesting, an opinion piece by a law student at the Osgoode Hall Law School in Toronto. And then we are going to share with you our most recent interview with Senator Kim Pate.
Good friend of the podcast.
Very good friend. Rivaling Peter Sankoff at this point as a multi-appearance guest. And Senator Pate has tabled a private member's bill in the Senate, which would finally, because of foot dragging on the part of the government, seek to reintroduce judicial discretion into sentencing. And we had a really interesting chat with her about that.
So before we talk about mandatory minimum sentences, something that I could talk about forever, because I have been talking about it forever.
For what feels like a lifetime.
Why don't you set up this Osgoode Hall law student?
So this is a piece that we read on the CBC, the Sunday edition website. It is authored by a law student by the name of Amanda Bird. And we've talked before on the podcast about ongoing issues, if I could put it that way, confronting women in the practice of law. We've talked on past episodes about the issue that the profession has in retaining women, despite the very high graduation rates. And this student wrote about her experience as a moot court competitor. So for those of you who are listening who are not lawyers or law students, moot competitions are essentially mock trials or mock appeals that are used for students to kind of hone their advocacy skills. And she writes about how after preparing for a moot known as the Price Media Law Moot, the competition was at Oxford University. And after preparing for 8 months, this student, Amanda Bird, had the opportunity to go to Oxford for the competition. And it was a, as she describes it, a very serious issue. And one of the things that students really look forward to in moot competitions is not only, you know, the result, did you win or lose, but is the feedback that you get, because you hear you have an opportunity to advocate in front of, you know, very distinguished and experienced lawyers and judges often. And she was disturbed to find that the feedback that she received was that she should smile more. And she took this as a sexist comment, in particular because her teammate was not given similar feedback, despite the fact that they, you know, both dealt with the issue with the seriousness that it warranted. And so, you know, a number of people were commenting on this on Twitter, and it led to a really interesting discussion about whether this type of a comment could ever be appropriate, whether it was a sexist comment. And and it actually led to quite an interesting discussion, I thought, among just a number of lawyers and legal academics. It's really difficult to assess without having actually seen her mooting. I am very much prepared to accept that there probably was sexism involved. Women, young women lawyers, experienced lawyers, are often criticized for things such as the tone of their voice.
Vocal fry.
Actually the topic of vocal fry came up in the course of the Twitter discussion that I was having, because it's tricky, again, without having seen her moot. I think it could be a sexist comment. I think it would be sexist if it was, you know, obviously not directed towards the male colleague, but at the same time, I do believe that it's very important as an advocate in court to develop a rapport with the bench and or with whomever, if it's a jury or whatever. And so I think it can be a valid comment that if a mooter or an advocate comes across as aloof or withdrawn or, you know, overly serious
or expressionless, like,
or expressionless.
I mean,
and I'm not saying that was the case here, because I don't know. And she knows how she performed, and she strongly felt that it was an inappropriate and likely sexist comment. And I am 100% prepared to accept that. I don't want to take that away from her or in any way seem to be minimizing her experience or making excuses for the judges. But it just kind of led, like, because someone asked, like, well, could it ever be appropriate to tell someone to smile more? And, you know, I think it really, to me, the answer is just, it depends.
Yeah, I think, I mean, how you approach your argument, how you carry yourself in court, your rapport with the bench or the jury is super important. And I think that it is probably not an appropriate thing to comment on when you're dealing with students getting their feet wet in these sorts of legal arguments. I mean, if that's the only criticism that you have to make, the leading comment should be, oh my gosh, that was entirely perfect.
It was a great argument.
It was a good argument. Your style was good. But, I mean, it is maybe the least important of all feedback. And given how it can be received, it probably is not the most appropriate feedback, because I'm sure there's other things that you can be critiquing or giving, you know, positive feedback too, when, you know, someone is new and starting to hone their advocacy. And the most important part, I think, the most important piece of advice you can give any young lawyer for appeals or trials is you have to be yourself and do what works for you. If you're not a smiley person, putting on a fake smile is the wrong way to go. I remember when I first started, a young lawyer, he will remain nameless, was doing one of his first trials and modeled his submissions and how he made his submissions off, you know, a very successful senior counsel who was very good at connecting with the bench and making submissions. It wasn't me, by the way.
And I had a friend.
Yeah. And within 5 minutes of making submissions in this conversational way, while sort of moving around and pacing and being informal, the judge told him to stay still, make eye contact, and stop being so distracting. So, I mean, I think you have to do what works for you. Like, my style is pretty informal. Like, I usually make the judge laugh at some point during my submissions by making some self-deprecating joke or some turn of phrase or something. But that's just because it sort of comes naturally and you can't force that stuff. So you have to do what works for you. But I do think that there is room to talk about sort of the demeanor in the courtroom. And I mean, there's nothing more boring or off-putting, because you have to remember judges have to pay attention and they're people too. And if you are not engaging in your submissions, then that can turn off the bench or cause them not to be as engaged, which, you know, may not be as good for your position. And so if you're coming off as overly robotic and emotionless, then, as I'm sure some students can when they're nervous and making these submissions for their first time, I think that there is some valid feedback there. But it sounds like this was just completely mishandled. And at the end of the day, if she feels that it was a sexist comment, that it was inappropriate, it probably was a sexist comment that was inappropriate.
Yeah, and it's hard because I think when you're a student or even a lawyer preparing for an appeal, for example, you know, your preoccupation is with the quality of and cogency of your legal argument. And I think as a student, that's probably what you're most looking for feedback on. And you do need to get feedback on the other things as well. But on the kind of other things piece, my experience, both having been a mooter and a moot court judge, is that the reality is you get really varied feedback. Like, different styles of advocacy resonate better with different people. And I remember what I found really frustrating, actually, Mike and I were moot partners in law school, and was in the preparation, and we would do the practice moots and stuff, is that you would almost get completely polar feedback. So you would have, you know, one counsel telling you to smile more and then another one telling you to smile less, or, you know, whatever it is. Some people, like you talked about pacing around during your submissions. That's not a style. I find that very distracting. I think, you know, you should stand in one place. You can use your hands a little bit for emphasis or whatever, but I don't know that you need to be pacing the courtroom, especially during an appeal, like an appellate type submission.
Yeah, you wouldn't do it during an appeal.
But other people find that like really engaging and dynamic. So it's tricky, because I think you kind of have to take that sort of feedback with a grain of salt. And I don't mean you should ever take, you know, blatantly sexist feedback with a grain of salt, because of course you shouldn't. And I think, you know, Ms. Byrne should be commended for writing the piece, because I think given the ongoing issues that the profession has with, you know, systemic gender-based discrimination, it's really, really important that these questions be raised, that these issues be aired. I didn't see anyone shutting her down. I didn't see anyone saying that's completely ridiculous. It was more, I think the discussion that followed from that, a lot of it was because we didn't see it. So we're sort of extrapolating from that and then discussing more generally about feedback and advocacy and then the matter of also age discrimination, because I think there are certain mannerisms and styles that older generations, wherever you are, sometimes find off-putting in younger people. And some of those are unfair and some of them are fair. So a big one, and Carissa Mamathan raised this on Twitter, and I completely agree with her, is the phenomenon of up-talking, or, you know, where everything is a question. You can't get up on your feet in court and make submissions and have everything be a question. And then that then led to the question about vocal fry and whether it is an affectation, whether it is something that people do intentionally, or whether it's just something that people do. But anyway, all that to be said, it just kind of goes to show how many moving pieces there are in the course of submissions. And my advice to the author of the piece would be, reflect on the comment, and feel free to dismiss it if you don't think it was valid. I would say, though, that I don't think that just because you're discussing a serious topic means you have to have a dour demeanor. And again, I don't know that that's what she had, but I'm just, putting that out there. But I don't think you have to smile to develop a rapport or be engaging either. I mean, I think you can achieve that mostly by making eye contact and by being responsive. So, but I think it's troubling when a young woman on the cusp of a career in the law is feeling that way. And I think her emphasis on how long she had prepared and how hard she had worked compounded the disappointment in getting a comment like that. And I would say to her that, at kind of as you said previously, that if that was the biggest criticism that they had, I think you did a pretty great job.
And her piece was really well written. And I mean, I'll say this, if she applies to my office, the resume is going on the top of the pile, because I mean, aside from the courtroom advocacy, I think her piece was great advocacy for the profession in general. And we definitely need more of that.
Agreed.
So, minimum sentences.
Minimum sentences are still a thing.
Are they now?
They are. Hopefully not for much longer.
And we've talked about minimum sentences a bunch.
Ad nauseum, one might say.
Can I give you just like 2 minutes of why they're so bad?
Yes, please do.
So minimum sentences are all over the criminal code, from first degree murder that has a mandatory, parole and an eligibility period, all the way down to impaired driving law that has mandatory license suspensions and minimum fines. The real problem with minimum sentences is that they remove discretion from the bench, from judges, to impose appropriate sentences, taking into account the individual circumstances of the offender and the particular circumstances of the offense. It's really a one-size-fits-all solution to, some very complex sentencing principles. The real problem with minimum sentences is that 90% of the time, probably the sentence is going to be around or higher than the minimum sentence. But there's the handful of cases where removing the flexibility to impose a lesser sentence really doesn't reflect, the principles of justice, and leads to sentences that are unfit, unfair, and quite often disproportionately impact some very marginalized groups. I mean, there's just so many problems with tying judges' hands so they can't impose the proper and just sentence.
Yeah, and I mean, the goal of the legislation, way back in the day when our entire body of criminal law was in the common law, so it was all judge-made, that had problems too, because, the law was not necessarily knowable in advance. And so, the decision was made that we would write down our criminal law in a code, in the criminal code. But deliberately, offenses also were kept relatively general, right? And we've talked before too about how much it drives us crazy when, you have an offense of theft, and then all of a sudden in response to a particular case, then you have a case of theft of X, theft of firefighting equipment or whatever it is. So we've tried to strike this balance between having a relatively comprehensive code on the one hand, but on the other hand, sufficient judicial discretion to ensure that the reality of the multitude of different ways that an offense can be committed can be recognized, an appropriate sentence, tailored to it. Senator Pate, as many of you know, before being appointed to the Senate, was the executive director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, which is an umbrella organization for local Elizabeth Fry Societies, which, advocate for and support incarcerated women, essentially. And so she has a lot of experience with, offenders in particular, and I think has seen firsthand how sentencing and unduly harsh sentences can really manifest in ways that are grossly unfair, and also how mandatory minimum sentences can, and we've talked about this before, lead to perverse incentives to plead guilty even when you're not guilty.
Well, and the crazy thing about minimum sentences is not just the perverse incentives to plead guilty to get around the minimum sentence, because Crowns can drop minimum sentence charges and have pleas entered to other charges. And so really you're shifting a reviewable form of appealable judicial discretion to this behind closed doors meeting with a Crown. But it can also minimum sentences can induce people who are actually guilty and would plead guilty to go to trial.
That's right.
Because if you know that you're going to get a minimum sentence, there really isn't much incentive to plead guilty because the savings of court time, expressions of remorse can't fully be captured through a guilty plea. And then when you look at minimum sentences, and we saw the conservatives for 10 years impose minimum sentence after minimum sentence, sometimes increasing within a year or two, the same minimum sentence multiple times. When you look at actually the criminological evidence on minimum sentences, they don't deter people from committing crimes. They don't reduce crime rates. And everything that we've seen shows that minimum sentences actually increase recidivism. That means that if you're sentenced to a minimum sentence, you're more likely to commit other offenses when you get out of jail. So they cause increasing jail populations, ballooning costs. They clog our courts with matters that could be resolved much earlier. They lengthen the process. And at the end of the day, they don't reduce crime and they don't make our streets any safer. So they really are a one-size-fits-all problem, not one solution.
One-size-fits-none. The part that I really appreciated about the discussion that we had with Senator Pate was I had reviewed her bill, but I hadn't quite connected the dots that it is in fact her intention to remove the mandatory 25-year parole ineligibility for people that are sentenced in respect of first-degree murder or any murder. That was really interesting to me because I feel like in the discussions that I've heard previously, it's generally been kind of repeal mandatory minimum sentences except for murder. And she makes a really interesting case, I think, and it was I really enjoyed that part of our discussion with her.
Yeah, and that's something, I mean, we didn't have a lot of time to talk with Senator Pate because literally the bells were ringing for a vote and we had to run out of her office. But I think that's something that I'd like to talk about more in a future episode because, I mean, there was, I think, sort of this grand bargain to get rid of the death penalty. We would get rid of the death penalty, but we would have this life sentence with a minimum parole ineligibility period for murder. And there, I think, was a political trade-off there that allowed us to get rid of the death penalty. And I don't know how long you have to wait before you go and start altering that trade-off. And, you know, if that could affect sort of other legal trade-offs that we might want to make in other policy areas.
That's true, although the trade-off itself has been undermined over time because we've, you know, done away with the faint hope clause and, you know, there's other...
You can now have consecutive life sentences. Consecutive life sentences. You can actually, as Kim says, and I wrote about this a little while ago, about how this the new consecutive life sentence bill is actually just bringing back the death penalty, but instead of a quick death by the state, it's a slow death behind bars by Father Time. So, I mean, it's an interesting topic, and it certainly is an ambitious bill that does a lot of what the Liberals, this our current government, said that they were going to do, but haven't done at all.
That's right. So, really interesting discussion. I agree with you. It was unfortunately a little bit short, but we were grateful for any time at all with Senator Pate, as always, and surely we'll have her on the podcast again.
Before we go over to our conversation with her, though,
is there something you want to chat about quickly?
I do want to just bring up Eamon Publishing's criminal law series.
It is quite an excellent series.
Because we've talked about a lot of the books, and last episode, we talked about the Indigenous People in the Criminal Justice System, a Practitioner's Handbook. There was one book that we maybe should have talked about last episode too.
Which book is that?
Prosecuting and Defending Fraud Cases.
Ooh. I could have used that book in my practice.
And, I mean, talking about, you know, breaks for corporate fraud buried in the budget implementation bill. It looks like, you know, maybe Grace Henson, David, and Jonathan Sheem are going to have to update their 2017 book.
True. I also wanted to just point out that Eamon Publishing was recently recognized with, and this is what I'm just trying to remember what it is exactly now.
You don't need to pull it up on your phone because I already have it.
Tell me.
So Eamon Publishing was just awarded the Hugh Lawford Award for Excellence in Legal Publishing.
I love how there's an award for everything, just like how there's awards for law blogs. So congratulations, Iman Publishing. We're very happy to be associated with such an esteemed and now decorated publisher.
An award-winning podcast, an award-winning sponsor.
Apropos.
And for our listeners, Iman is offering 10% off all the titles in the criminal law or in the criminal law series. All you have to do is visit iman.ca/CLS and enter code DOCKET10 at checkout.
Happy reading.
So go do that.
So, Senator Pate, welcome back to the docket. We used to know you as Kim, but now we're going to be formal with you.
Oh, yeah. And my last one was classic. Oh, my God. I listened to it. It was,
well, you were in Australia or something?
Yeah. I was just about to go into a funeral. So, it was like, anyway.
Thank you for taking the time.
It was ridiculous. When I listened to it, I just thought, oh, anyway, sorry.
No, but what was funny about that, too, I think I commented about it on the podcast, was that I had said to Mike, I'm surprised Kim knows how to send an audio file. Yeah. Listen to it. I was like, perfect.
Yeah. She does not know how to send an audio file. She hustled, yeah.
But you went to the trouble and we appreciated that.
I don't know. Anyway.
But we're really excited to be here to talk to you today about your private members bill, because this is an issue that we've talked about a lot on the docket, that lots of elected officials seem to have talked about a lot over the years, but for some reason, nothing has really happened about mandatory minimums until now. So maybe you could just tell us a bit about your bill to start.
Sure. Well, the bill is not my original thought. Erwin Kotler, when he was an MP, first introduced an iteration of this bill. And when I was looking at it, I thought, well, you know, the ideally would be to repeal a whole bunch of the mandatory minimum sentences that have been passed. It's clear that there is, you know, there's some appetite for that, but it also means then you have to bring the justification for every single provision. And so it felt like, you know, when I saw his idea, I just thought, well, there are many jurisdictions that have this kind of provision already, where you can, judges have mandatory minimum and sentences, but where they consider, according to the circumstances, whether it's of the accused, the victim, the circumstances all around of what's happened, it's not appropriate to impose a mandatory minimum. They don't have to. And then added in, he had to provide some reasons, and I thought, well, written reasons in serious cases would be valid for all kinds of reasons, you know, in terms of not just for appeals, but also to assist if someone is getting a jail sentence. Those written reasons can really assist you in determining how, what kind of programming, what kind of supports, what kind of classification people should have. So, and then the other was to put in the introductory, you know, sort of like a preamble in the beginning, to explain why we're looking at all mandatory minimum sentences, not just the ones that a lot of others have looked at. So, including murder, because of really going back decades in this country, the recommendations have been to look at the mandatory minimum for murder, especially since the trade-off of the increased parole ineligibility periods for the elimination of the death penalty. And what we saw then is this massive increase, you know, from 10 to 25 years for first-degree murder. And then the faint hope clause was put in place, but then it was eliminated. And the last time the Supreme Court of Canada looked at the constitutionality of the murder provisions, we still had a faint hope clause. And, you know, it was really ruled, you know, shouldn't say it was ruled constitutional, but it certainly wasn't ruled unconstitutional because of the faint hope clause, and now that's gone, and we now have essentially multiple life sentences. We've essentially reinstated a death sentence in this country, and so that's all the backdrop to it. And then I started having discussions with the government. Well, I was involved in some of the consultation meetings as soon as the current government was elected, and they started to have consultation meetings. In keeping with the mandate letters of both the Minister of Public Safety and Minister of Justice. And this was one of the first recommendations in almost every consultation that I was either part of or heard about. And yet, and it was also part of the mandate of the minister, and it was also part of the election platform, not squarely as get rid of mandatory minimum penalties, but as the call to action number 32 is squarely of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, is squarely within the mandate and the platform of the federal government. So, you know, I was told it would be coming, and then once I saw Bill C-75, was pretty clear. That seems like it's the last crime bill that they would be, or the criminal justice bill they'd be introducing. So then it became clear to me that it likely wasn't coming. And so I, as I had said to them, if I see nothing by a certain time period, I actually went longer. I initially had said by the end of 2017. And then, I was encouraged to wait, and so I did wait. And then when I saw C-75, I realized we're not getting it this term and felt the need to introduce it. Whether it'll get through, whether we'll prorogue before it gets to committee, in any event, I'm committed now to, however long it takes to get this through, I'll introduce it again if I need to. And as one seasoned senator, now retired, said to me, just keep doing it, just keep, and has known me a long time and said, and I think you will. And I figured that's my walking papers to keep
pushing.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we talked about, I think maybe at the end of 2017, is that it seems like the Senate and provinces are sort of picking up the slack on justice reform that isn't necessarily coming from the federal government. And do you think, mandatory minimum sentences have always been sort of a hot button political issue, despite the fact that there's decades of evidence that they don't really work and about all their costs. Do you think that maybe the Senate is the place where this sort of bill has to start, because it just would take so much political capital to start it in the House of Commons?
Well, it's interesting. A number of people have suggested that as well, that it's not, that none of the parties have a political appetite to take on something that may take a lot of public education for the electorate to get behind. I actually, of course, I don't have to rely on being elected, so it's maybe easy for me to say, but I actually think the more people know about it, if you just ask the question, most people, might give a knee-jerk response, and just like the old question, the cliche adage or whatever the appropriate term is, if you do the crime, should you do the time? Well, most people say, yeah, and you just have to peel back one layer, and people will say, have a far more nuanced answer. So, for instance, victims, oftentimes they're used as the excuse to have harsher penalties, and yet in all of the surveys of people who have been victimized, the first thing they want is information, and particular information about, why them, and how to prevent it from happening to someone else, and sometimes, oftentimes how to remedy whatever loss they've had. And so none of that is achieved by harsh sentencing. And so I don't think it takes as much as people think to educate the public to come on side. And I think what we do need, I would love to see one of the parties take this position. And actually, the NDP has offered to sponsor, one NDP member, I should say. I'm cloaking them all. Yeah. Has offered to sponsor the bill in the House. A couple of backbench liberals have also said they'd like to, but my guess is once they consult, they may not be able to, or however, those sorts of things work. But since the speech, although there was hardly anybody here, it was late at night, on a Thursday night, many of the people who have read it now have said that they hadn't thought of some of the issues that we raised. And we did spend a lot of time, and I say we because, of course, it's the collectivity. I've consulted with people, I've sent it out to lawyers, I've sent it out to academics, I consulted with people who are serving life sentences. We have interns here, we had 15 legal interns, they all looked at it as well. And so tried to get, and other senators and MPs, so tried to get as fulsome, as much input as possible to me, not because I think any bill is ever perfect put together, but to really make sure that I was thinking of as broad a range of issues as possible. And then putting the speech together, the same thing, we tried to cover off, okay, what are the sticking points that people say, well, yeah, but, and that's when we said, really we have to take on squarely murder, because if we don't, we'll just pretend like we're not, and, that could be the first one hived off. It might be one that people try to amend out. But I feel very strongly it's the one that pushes all the rest of them, and so it makes it okay to be punitive in so many other areas if we're okay to do it there. And I'm not saying there aren't a lot of people who should be serving long sentences and should be held accountable all of their lives, but there's also an awful lot of people I know who have been on parole now for 30, 40, one of them over 50 years, who everybody, including their parole officer, the family members of the person who was killed, all believe, like, okay, enough. Like, and so, you know, I think there's also an appetite beyond this to look at what do we do once people have, you know, have done a lot of time in prison, have been accountable, because if you're serving a life sentence, even if you get parole, you're never free. You're, you know, just to go from, you know, depending on your radius, 50 kilometers, which isn't that far, you have to get a travel permit to go if you're serving a life sentence. You have to get authorization to go to a wedding. You often can't cross borders. So, you know, a lot of people don't think about that the life sentence really is truly a life sentence, and that has a huge impact. And when you consider, particularly, and why I focused on women in the, not just because that's who I've worked with for most of the last 25, 30 years, but even, you know, as I am talking to more of the men, clearly there's examples there, but the examples I use were women whose situations I knew quite well, one that had been written about also by Liz Sheehy, and who we looked at following the self-defense review. And, you know, when we look at the situations of women, and you see that of the women getting life sentences, half of them are Indigenous. And when you realize that many of them have pled guilty, when you start to unpack that and see that most of it was reacting to violence, not all of it defensive, some of it defensive others, some self-defense, but when you put that context in, you understand why so many of them plead guilty as well, as how then if you look at the manslaughter charges, huge numbers of manslaughter charges, and almost all of those have an element of defense in them. And yet we know most crimes, there are a few examples where we've managed to intervene before they've got to the stage where the pleas are being entered. And in two situations in the past decade, I've worked with Crown, you know, I've offered to assist with Crowns and Defense Counsel, and charges have been withdrawn. But in most cases, as soon as the Crown hears about abuse, a history of abuse, they'll offer a deal for manslaughter, and women will plead. Well, the pressure for that deal to manslaughter is the life sentence, and is the, you know, the risk of children being put on the stand if they're the only witnesses, and all of those things that we know really disproportionately will impact the women. So
I'm not surprised to hear that. People who might have been skeptical upon reading the speech saw it in a completely different light, and your particular emphasis on women, and in particular women in violent relationships, and on Indigenous people, and tying it specifically to the Truth and Reconciliation recommendations, it is really persuasive. And I didn't realize before I read the bill that it wasn't the intent of the bill to exclude murder from the discretion, the judicial discretion. And I think you made the case really persuasively. It's not something I had really spent a lot of time thinking about myself, just because I take it as such a given, because for my entire legal career, it's been there. And I was sort of vaguely aware of this notion that the mandatory life with 25-year parole ineligibility had been a trade-off or a compromise for abolishing the death penalty.
Yeah, part of a grand bargain that was sort of struck, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So, but is it the case then that when we did have capital punishment, it wasn't mandatory?
There was a life sentence for non-capital murder, but the parole ineligibility period was 10 years.
Okay.
And so, and it was less too, because when, for instance, I'll use the example of Stephen Truscott, when his death sentence was overturned, he was then out within less than 7 years. Now, that would never ever happen in a first degree now.
Yeah.
And he was able to change his name, and it wasn't, you probably know the story, it wasn't until his children became adolescents and were reading about his case that he and his wife, who had been one of the main advocates for, you know, his appeals, told the kids, and they didn't even know they were that their dad was Stephen Truscott, even though they were studying in school until they disclosed. That could never happen now. If someone has a life sentence, then they're forever in the public eye. That can't think of any circumstances where their identity could be protected, even for the protection of their children. And he lived with this parole officer for a while. Like, all of those sorts of things, these humanizing features that have virtually been obliterated from our system.
What people need to understand is that bringing discretion in and abolishing mandatory minimums doesn't mean that a lot of people won't get long sentences. That's right.
And in fact, what I'm proposing, one of the criticisms, the Criminal Lawyers Association has already come out, and it may be in the papers already, but in one of the criticisms is this is a nice gesture, but it doesn't go far enough, because it's actually not abolishing any mandatory minimum sentences. It's providing a way for judges to not impose them. And so, their view is that was the easy way, and I don't disagree with them. I'm not so sure. Doesn't feel as easy as I think they think it is, but I do think it's easier than the alternative, particularly in a climate where there's not an appetite to take it on. So,
and I think the more you look at minimum sentences, the more you can see that no matter what side of the political spectrum or what side of the crime control versus civil liberties or charter rights, and it's sort of a false dichotomy to set up, but no matter what side of that divide you're on, minimum sentences don't make sense, because the evidence is that if you impose minimum sentences, it actually increases future recidivism, and so if you're about safe streets and things like that, minimum sentences actually don't make our streets safer. And at the same time, if you look before the trial and before sentencing, it's a powerful incentive, minimum sentences are, to have not only guilty people accept responsibility to things that they're not responsible for. Just looking at manslaughter and murder, I don't know anyone who would turn down a manslaughter plea when they're facing a second degree or first degree murder. But at the same time, it also, if you're guilty and you want to take responsibility, there's very little incentive to actually take responsibility. So on the one hand, it induces guilty pleas from the innocent, and it sort of incentivizes people who would otherwise plead guilty to have court time and have victims come and testify at court. So it doesn't seem like anyone really wins.
No, I agree. And one of the women's situations I wanted to talk about, but I couldn't get hold of the woman, is an Indigenous woman who it was pretty clear she had defended herself. No defense was put forward. She was working in the street. She was in the sex trade. She had been attacked by a guy. She escaped from his place. Then he chased her with his car, pinned her, and she had grabbed a knife in his place, still had it stabbed him once. He died. And, horrible situation, but pretty clear. He was actually unlike most of the cases, it was not quite hand-to-hand combat, but it was certainly the
dynamic situation.
There was no issue about imminence, for sure, and in all of the things that often come up, in particularly when you're talking about women trying to defend themselves. And so... and in that case, she won the appeal. But as soon as she won the appeal, the Crown offered her a deal for time served if she pled to manslaughter. And she had had a jury trial, first time round. And she said, I remember talking to her, and she was in jail. And because she lived on reserve, she had nothing to put up, because on reserve, the band jointly owns your house, even if you own your house. And so I'd offered to put up my house. I was so worried that she would plead guilty just because she was in custody and waiting to get back with her son, who she just reunited with. And she called me and said, "No, I'm going to take the deal." And I was tried everything I could. And finally, she just said to me, "Can you guarantee me that I will be acquitted this time if I go to trial?" And I said, "Well, no." And she was, her words were, "I'm an Indian. So what if I have a record for manslaughter? Like, most Indians have records. And, but I'll probably go to jail again. Probably they won't believe me again," because it was a white guy who had... And I just, I was horrified. So even when the system works, or in that case, the appeal process worked, it looked like everything worked, you know, and I'm not saying the Crown was being, you know, I wish the Crown would have just dropped the charges. I think they should have. That's my personal view. But, you know, as an officer of the court, they could have, because it wasn't in, I don't think, in the interest of justice. Instead, they offered her the deal. She took the deal. She, to this day, has a manslaughter conviction. She didn't go back to jail. She got out then, and she didn't have to sit on remand either. But, you know, it's just, that to me is sort of epitomizes exactly what you were just talking about, Michael, about the pressure that's put on and the inability to overcome all of the other problems with the system, the racism, you know, sometimes the misogyny, the class bias, you know, all of those sorts of things that, and the fact that, you know, even when they put her on bail or attached a surety to her release, you know, I wanted to go and argue it's unconscionable for most Indigenous people to actually impose that. It means you're actually ensuring that they're all going to spend time in prison, which we know they mostly do too, awaiting trial, because they don't have resources. Mm-hmm. And even if they have family members at home, they're not allowed to put them up.
So the other thing that I wanted to bring up about the bill is, because we've talked a lot about murder and the most serious charges, and often when we talk about mandatory minimum sentences, it's murder and, you know, trafficking drugs to children and mm-hmm. sexual offenses. But there's so many minimum sentences in the code, including sort of minimum orders that can follow a conviction, like driving prohibitions and other type of prohibitions that your bill also addresses.
And victim surcharges that have been struck down largely but have not yet been taken out of the... Well, there's some gesture towards that, but it hasn't been taken out yet. And registries and the things that there could also be discretion. It's interesting, the day that I spoke about the bill and we ended up putting it in the news release as a result, was the three largest police unions came out in support of judicial discretion to not impose mandatory minimum. And as one of my colleagues who's a former police officer said, well, you know, it's kind of self-serving because, you know, now police officers are getting charged with weapons offenses, but you know, some of the,
that was in Priscilla, yeah,
and some of the first the proliferation with the Liberal when the Liberals were in power were all the gun control bills, and mm-hmm. and so we knew, you know, for instance, there were a couple of people who had used weapons even though it was they were convicted of manslaughter, and there was, you know, a strong element that there was defense, but there wasn't, you know, enough evidence to either convince the judge, usually the judge, but sometimes the jury. Some of those individuals got conditional sentences, and now they can't. Now the judges don't have that discretion. So it's also looking at, you know, just discretion to also get rid of some of those penalties or prohibitions as well.
Yeah, one of the most heartbreaking cases I had nothing to do with murder or drugs or weapons, but it was a guy with no record who was convicted of a driving offense, an impaired driving. And I think his readings were just barely over the limit, and there was no accident. And he was a good guy who just made a mistake. But I remember, this is early in my career when I drove my clients to court sometimes, I was driving him home and I dropped him off in the country. And he just broke down bawling in the car because he didn't have public transportation. He was going to lose his job. And he didn't have friends to drive him around. And he was responsible for driving his wife from the country into the city for cancer treatment. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he would have resolved the charges. I'm sure it would have saved his family a ton of grief. And I mean, I don't know what ended up happening in the end. If the judge could have, you know, imposed a driving prohibition, but given an exception to, you know, use his car while sober to drive his wife to cancer treatments.
Right.
And I think your bill takes care of situations like that, too.
Well, I would hope so, for sure. And you know, the other piece there, is, I mean, just the bill that we're in the midst of looking at right now, the cannabis, to not put the responsibility on car manufacturers, for instance, and others that could be, you know, the fact that there are now mechanisms that exist that could prevent you from driving a car when you're drinking, like, and who knows what they'll come up with for drugs, but, you know, the fact that instead of pushing to have car manufacturers, you know, we did it for emissions testing, maybe not as great as we should for climate control, but, you know, why not have that be the focus too? If we're actually interested in eliminating the harm, or in those situations, you know, I don't know if he was eligible for the treatment option, but the fact that it's mostly wealthy people who get access to the treatment option when, in the impaired driving charges.
You have to be able to afford to do all the things to your car and go through the program, yeah. And there's still a prohibition period that you have to comply with, too.
But there's also, if the Crown agrees that you can go for treatment and show that you've dealt with everything, there's an ability to go around some of the mandatory penalties, and so the fact that that is, that's a privileged position. It's where if, you know, if I have the resources to go to the Mayo Clinic or to what, you know, I'm just making up, I don't know where you go, but, yeah. You know, if you have the resources, we know that the waiting lists are such that most crowns wouldn't agree to give that exemption for the average person charged. And the fact that it requires crown approval is a whole other issue. Mm-hmm. And I think there should be discretion to say, look, if this person clearly has, you know, addictions issues that are, and, you know, they may be rooted in, you know, historical trauma, residential school or abuse or whatever. And I say whatever, not to be dismissive, but there could be a bigger piece there. And if treatment is a much better option to prevent this person from being in the situation and to, you know, basically remedy as best you can the, what's happened, why not do that? And, you know, that's the other thing that that I think we don't look enough at is if we're really, I raised it in my speech, the fact that we still use deterrence. I mean, I don't know why maybe that'll be another, you know, proposal is to actually get deterrence out of sentencing principles, because it's, I can't think of any more cases that we need to say that it's basically...
It's just not effective.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, the point you made just anecdotally about car manufacturers, for example, it's just really important for people to realize that trying to rely on things like mandatory minimum punishments to fix really complex social problems is, like, lazy and ineffective. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like, it's just so you can say you've done something, but you haven't even really done anything.
Well, and so we don't take responsibility. You put the responsibility on the person who, in that moment, in that particular instance, you can... attribute responsibility, but not all the rest of us. If we really wanted to prevent this,
right,
there's things could be done.
And I think, you know, just to circle back to what we were talking about at the very beginning about why maybe it's hard for Parliament, or it's perceived as hard to kind of tackle an issue like this, I had a funny exchange on Twitter with someone when C-75 came out, and I made a comment about no mandatory minimums, and the person said, oh, maybe they're saving it for the election. They want to save it to announce it. And I said, I don't think so. But it's interesting because for some people who don't work in the justice system, these are really new issues for them. And it was an issue that the Liberals during the election campaign talked about. Like, they, mm-hmm. you know, they talked about abolishing mandatory minimums. So they obviously felt there was some appetite. And the fact that some people have gotten really on board, kind of in the same way that people got really on board the opposition of Bill C-51 under Harper, although it was a nuanced and kind of complex thing. And I think in a lot of different domains, we really underestimate the public's ability to understand complex issues. It's as though we or, you know, elected officials have the monopoly on being able to understand complex things. And I think that's really, really unfair. And when I was a candidate, I often talked to people about that. I thought, mm-hmm. you know, we don't need to use such blunt instruments just because we don't think the electorate will understand. And if we don't think the electorate will understand, then it's incumbent upon us to explain it to them.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And not just in, like, 6 words talking points, but actually taking the time to explain things like you did in your speech and in conversations like this one. Mm-hmm. So I'm not totally persuaded. And that's why I find it so confounding that they still haven't done it, because they seemed comfortable talking about it during the election campaign. It's in the mandate letter. And in particular, the mandatory minimums that have actually been found unconstitutional already, that those weren't repealed when they took out the zombie laws and other things. Like, that's the part I don't really understand. And when they say we're looking at it, maybe for murder, they want to be able to really make the case if they ever wanted to go there. But for the ones that the Supreme Court has already said, and for the victim's fine surcharge, which they already said they were going to, you know, bring back discretion to, it's just, I feel genuinely confused. Mm-hmm. And I hope that the Senate doesn't become like the new Supreme Court. Like, we're going to have to let an unelected group deal with these issues because they're just too challenging for the electorate, and so let someone else do the hard work. I think it would be unfortunate, even though I'm glad that there's such good work that's happening.
No, I think it's a good point, and it's interesting. A few of the NDP friends who are elected officials have said, you know, well, maybe NDP's got to rethink this position on the Senate if this is what the role is. I'm joking, of course.
No, but I feel that way. I mean, I was always a bit less, like, diehard on the abolish the Senate for the reason that I saw under Harper how much of the work that helped the Supreme Court in looking at bills came from the Senate. Mm-hmm. It was the work that the Senate had done and the reports and the kind of more fulsome investigation or inquiry into bills that actually served a really useful purpose in the courts. So,
Speaking of Senate
we hear a bell.
And useful work, I hear some bells.
Yes, I know. We've got to go for a vote on C-46.
Well, that's an interesting one.
Yeah.
Got some stuff to say. I'll be looking at how you vote. I've got some stuff to say on that bill.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, as you know, we usually like to abuse our guests by making them talk to us for longer than they've agreed to. But in this case, we do hear a literal bell that is telling us that the time is up.
I know, and we become like cows when you come to this place.
You got to do
hear
it.
The bell, you got to go.
Are you drooling like you hear the bell?
Yeah.
It's
not
kind of love.
So, thank you as always for taking the time to talk to
thank
us.
You guys.
And won't be the last time, I hope. Oh. You're one of the good friends of the podcast. Sorry, Peter Sankoff, but Kim has been on the podcast probably close to as much.
Three times
as
now.
As many times as Peter.
Yeah.
So,
that's great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, and good luck with your bill.
You too.
So once again, a huge thanks to Kim Pate for taking the time to meet with us and talk about her bill. What I'll do in the show notes on the website and in the description of this episode, if you're listening on iTunes, I'll link to both a copy of her speech that she made to introduce the bill, which is, I think, a very powerful and moving speech, and I'll link to a copy of the bill itself.
Yes, definitely. And did we mention there were fresh baked chocolate chip cookies in her office?
I don't know. They were like, this is what makes it even better. They weren't fresh baked. They were like 2 or 3 days old, but they still tasted fresh baked.
They were delicious.
They were amazing.
Thank you. Just in closing, before we wrap up, we wanted to share some news that we're kind of excited about. Some of you may recall way back when I first joined the podcast, whenever that was it 2015?
I think so.
We did an episode by episode analysis of the Netflix crime docuseries, Making a Murderer, and we are very happy to tell you that we are about to embark on a similar project in relation to the docuseries, The Staircase. This is something that I watched a couple of years ago and was really excited about the idea of trying to recreate the magic of our Making a Murderer series in relation to The Staircase, except that unfortunately at the time, it was very difficult to find it anywhere. I had managed to borrow basically the DVD from someone. and so we decided that it wouldn't really be practical because not a lot of people would have access to watching the source material. However, it has now just recently been released on Netflix, and not only has it been released on Netflix, but Netflix has produced 3 additional episodes. So these are episodes that I've not yet seen. You've not seen any of it yet. And it raises a lot of similar issues that come up in Making a Murderer, albeit in a very different context, and in particular with a very privileged accused, which will be a big contrast between the accused and Making a Murderer. But just raises a lot of really interesting ethical issues in terms of prosecutors and the courts, and also just is a really fascinating story of a very interesting and kind of really unexpected case. So it's available to watch on Netflix. If you think this will be of interest to you, I encourage you to start watching, and we're going to start doing the same.
Yeah, and if anyone has any thoughts on format or anything like that, I think we'd be really receptive. We're sort of thinking about some different ideas, if we should maybe, like Netflix does, just release, record like an after show for each one and release them all at the same time in one batch, or if they should be spread out. I'm also thinking maybe if we do them sort of a bit shorter, like, you know, 15 or 20 minute hits after each episode. I don't know. I think there's still room there to maybe do something a bit different with the format.
Yeah, so tweet us, email us, let us know. And but either way, we're going to be getting on that. So get on watching The Staircase on Netflix.
Will do. Nice smile. Bye.
Thank you to Jeremy Fisher for allowing us to use his awesome song, Uh-Oh, as our introduction music. You can check out more at the podcast page at michaelspratt.com, or you can subscribe to The Docket on iTunes. If you like it, spread the word. You can follow Emily on Twitter at Emily Tamman, and you can follow me on Twitter at MSpratt. Thanks for listening. You can't prove it. Oh, you got nothing legit. Oh, the glove don't fit.
heat.